Any for Tuesday, April 19th, 2005. First item on the agenda is House Bill 5051, Oregon Military Department. We will be in a work session, and we're going to be at ease for just a few minutes. We need to have a quorum in order to move these motions through.
We just need Senator Devlin.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to... I was on the phone. Are you going to wait a minute? Because my staff's gone. I'll run back up and get mine.
This will begin a work session on House Bill 5051, the Oregon Military Department. Ms. Jordan, if you would walk us through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee will be walking through this memo that I gave you yesterday. Senator Devlin, do you have your copy?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through the technical adjustments and the policy packages, and then I'll pause there for a motion to approve the LFO recommendations and then discussion, and then I'll move through the rest of the memos on the bill itself, the capital construction portion, and then the performance appraisal. The first item are technical adjustments. These are adjustments to the PERS rate. There was a reduction in the PERS rate, so we've adjusted the agency's budget in each of the program areas by $6,013 total. Oh, I'm sorry, the PERS rate is $266,774 total. The DAS assessment is $33,202. The AG rate reduction results in $6,013 for a total reduction in the agency's budget of $305,989. The first policy package, which is the facility lease, $1,369,347 general fund. LFO recommends approval. Debt service in package 83 of $459,300 general fund. LFO recommends approval. On package 108, the unspecified National Guard appreciation package, LFO is not recommending it at this time. I'm recommending that once all of the proposals have been evaluated by the substantive committees and sent to the Joint Ways and Means, that the subcommittee discuss legislative priorities and establish expenditure limitation in the end of session bill or in the substantive legislation itself. So all of those proposals can be prioritized before we put a dollar amount on it.
Representative Wisnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'd like to put in the record that the Guard did not disagree with that either, and they said they did not disagree with it because there's some federal programs that they think will take care of their people adequately without that. Is that in fact true?
Some of it, yes.
Colonel Caldwell, would you please come forward and put your comments on the record?
Yes, ma'am.
If you would, thank you. And good afternoon.
For the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department.
Yeah, well, we just, for the committee's edification, the governor's appreciation package, part of that is still being discussed in the substantive committees. Reference education packages, all the education packages for soldiers is pretty much taken care of by the federal government, almost 100% plus. But the governor's package also addressed, or was trying to address, or suggested to address, family members and other folks. There are several bills, both Senate and House, that are still working their way through that are going to end up here before you at some point. So I think this is the right decision in my mind. Wait for those to get their review before you reenter this discussion.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think for the record, we want to say that because the governor's package was nonspecific in how it was going to be awarded, that the Veterans Committee and the House and Senate committees are looking at specific proposals that would be to recognize and show our Guard appreciation. And so that's why we're okay with taking this out of the budget at this point. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think that's a good characterization.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'd also point out that both the co-chairs have identified significantly more money than what was in the budget, in their co-chair budget, to allow for some expansion of what was in the governor's budget, so that can be discussed later.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would only ask, and this may be on your mind already, Madam Chair,
is that you ask the co-chairs that when those items come from some subcommittees, and two ways and means that they come to this subcommittee for final consideration.
We will make that request. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Please continue.
Okay, package 110, our administrative position. This was these positions were added after the governor's budget was already put together. They're requesting converting a limited duration office specialist two in the personnel office to a permanent full-time and reclassifying human resource assistant to an analyst one, an accountant two to an accountant three, and the package would be funded by other funds, which is actually federal funds through their centralized personnel plan, so it's 100% federally funded. LFO is recommending approval with an adjustment of $486 for the PERS rate reduction. Package 201 is the Portland National Guard Base operations and maintenance money. It's $50,360 general fund, $290,504 federal funds. LFO is recommending approval. Package 202, Kingsley Field Air National Guard Base, $61,200 general funds, $346,800 federal funds. LFO recommends approval. Package 205, Baker City Readiness Center. This is $86,551. The agency requested general fund. LFO is recommending the expenditure limitation but shifting the source of funds to general funds to come from their rental income. Package 206, Lane County Field Maintenance Shop. This is the agency requests $71,222 general fund and $49,665 federal funds. LFO is recommending an expenditure limitation of $70,940 adjusted by the PERS rate reduction and that it be shifted to other funds and the full federal funds amount.
Is that $71,228?
$22.
$22. Okay.
Package 207 is the Army National Guard installation positions, $81,493 federal funds. LFO is recommending approval, the adjusted by $382 for the PERS rate reduction. Package 211 is a Central Oregon Readiness Center, $60,000 general fund. LFO is recommending approval. Package 212, the Army National Guard Operations and Maintenance Federal Funds, $5 million federal funds. LFO is recommending approval. Package 216, Kingsley Field and Portland Air Base Family Program, $19,350 federal funds. LFO is recommending approval. Package 217, reclassification of five positions, $34,981 federal funds. LFO recommends approval with the adjustment of $255 for the PERS rate reduction. Package 218 converts five limited duration positions to permanent full-time at $493,455 federal funds. LFO recommends approval adjusted by $2,914 for the PERS rate reduction. Package 219 converts the two limited duration positions to permanent full-time positions, $169,438 federal funds. LFO is recommending approval with the adjustment of $962 for the PERS rate reduction. Package 220 is operation staffing levels to establish two natural resource, four positions in the environmental branch, a trades maintenance supervisor at Camp Withycombe, and reclassification of three labor positions from seasonal to permanent full-time for $472,685 other funds, and LFO recommends approval with the PERS rate reduction adjustment of $2,831 and package 403.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Susie, can you give us some, now where's the, when you're talking other funds, is this going to be money we're making from doing the work at the maintenance facility there, or what's the other?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, this this package is funded also through the centralized personnel plan agreement, which is 100% federal funded. It's the administrative pullback from the federal portion of their budget. Package 403 converts one limited duration position to permanent full-time for work with at-risk youth in the Youth Challenge Program. This is $33,350 other funds, $50,026 federal funds. LFO recommends approval with the reduction for PERS rates of 189 other funds and 283 federal funds. And that's all of the policy packages and LFO recommendations for those two areas.
Ms. Jordan, let me go back to 206 with you. What I thought I heard you say was 71,000.
71,222 is the amount the agency requested. LFO is recommending. Oh, I see there's two different numbers
right
there.
Mm-hmm.
The number is 70,940 that LFO is recommending.
All right. So, all right. That. Thank you. Colonel Caldwell, please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of Military Department. Package 220, I think we have crossed our wires with your very good staff, and we said other funds, that should be federal funds.
Well.
So sorry.
Thank you, Colonel. Any questions or comments? Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion if that's all right.
Certainly.
Madam Chair, I'd move the subcommittee approve the technical adjustments and LFO recommendations on the policy packages.
We have a motion to approve the technical adjustments and LFO recommendations on the policy packages. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'll bear with me for a minute, with that change in the federal funds, I need to make a little calculated adjustment in the recommendation on the bill. Just make my numbers.
Just ever so slightly.
Well, calculations are occurring, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I'd like to point out the euphemism of end of session bill was mentioned in one of the. I'm pleased to see that come forward because I've heard there will be no Christmas tree bill this year, so end of session bill seems to have might fill the needed void.
Well, we're really pleased that you brought your sense of humor along with you this afternoon, Representative Hansen.
Might be a cat burglar bill and steal stuff away at the end of the session. So.
The committee is at ease.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Would Ms. Jordan be so good as to give us the new number?
I would like to do
thank
that.
You.
Thank you. The LFO is recommending adjustments in House Bill 5051 in line 6 on general funds to delete $16,771,846 and insert $15,857,145 in other funds, line 8, to delete $7,950,565 and insert $6,167,145. In the federal funds, line 13, to delete $69,831,291 and insert $62,326,465. I want to just double check that one more time.
So you got 167, 145.
62,326,465. Yes. Thank you.
Moving forward.
Do we need to amend them?
And one more thing in the bill to add the new section to handle the increased federal funds for operations and maintenance resulting from the increased federal revenue through the end of the 2003-05 biennium. This is a supplemental budget that we talked about yesterday would be amended into this bill as well.
Do we need to do an amendment?
No.
Based on the figures that you just adjusted?
No.
Okay.
you would make your motion based on the figures that I just read to you.
Representative Hanna?
Based on Ms. Jordan's discussion, short discussion of the amendment to 5051, are you then ready for a motion for that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd move that the subcommittee approve the amendments to House Bill 5051 with a due pass recommendation to the full Committee on Ways and Means.
We have a motion to approve the amendments to House Bill 5051 with a due pass recommendation to the full Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item is the capital construction policy option packages. The agency had requested that $7,750,000 federal funds and $2 million other funds be approved for five projects: Camp Rylea fire suppression, $1.5 million federal funds; Camp Rylea training center campus, $1.5 million federal funds; Camp Rylea utility upgrades, $2 million federal funds; Salem Mail Distribution Center, $750,000 federal funds, $2 million other funds; and Camp Wickenton infrastructure upgrades, $2 million federal funds. And LFO is recommending approval. These projects are in a separate bill, House Bill, Senate Bill 5504, and are not before the committee at this time, but the committee needs to make a recommendation to approve these before the subcommittee will, that is assigned that bill, would consider that.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that the subcommittee approve the capital construction project budget.
We have a motion to approve the capital construction projects budget as presented by LFO. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then we'll move to the performance appraisal, performance measures, which is this one-page sheet. There are several measures that co-chairs have requested be added to the military department. They have proposed two. The recommendation is to add a measure to compare the revenue generated from facility rental to the potential revenue capacity. To add three measures for the Youth Challenge Program: percent of students graduating from the academic phase, percent of 17 to 18-year-olds completing their GED or high school diploma at graduation, and the number of students who are still in school or working 12 months after graduating the program. An additional performance measure is recommended for the percent of production for refurbished military equipment meeting the National Guard Bureau requirements. And then the two measures that all budgets are getting for customer satisfaction: percent of customers rating their overall satisfaction with the agency above average or excellent, and percent of customers rating satisfaction with the agency services above average or excellent for timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, and information availability.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that the subcommittee approve the additions to the performance measures as presented by Legislative Fiscal Office.
We have a motion to approve the additions to the performance measures as presented by the Legislative Fiscal Office. Is there any discussion? Representative Hanson.
Very, very quick question. That's just, has any thought or discussion occurred on how we define who would be the customers of the National Guard?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the agency will have to define who their customers are. The thinking behind these two measures is that all agencies have customers and that they should be performing at some level, and that DAS and LFO will assist the agencies in working through these measures. I'm not so sure that one size fits all, personally.
It should be interesting next session.
I'm just sure you're going to with
that. You are a customer of the military department.
Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is approved. I will carry the bill in the full committee. Representative Wisnot, would you carry in the House?
Be glad to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin. To join me in carrying this on the Senate side?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5051 and open the hearing on House Bill 5016, Department of Corrections. And we are pleased to have some invited testimony this afternoon. Let me just back up a bit. Colonel Caldwell, thank you. Thank you 1,000 times. And to all of those who serve with you, we thank you for the tour on Friday, and again, the hospitality, and again, we honor your service. Thank you.
You can do this on Thursday if you want to.
Hold open a date for us. Returning to the record, I'd like to invite forward Craig Campbell. Okay. And I'm going to ask that Mr. Wilson, Doug Wilson, walk us through a handout that I believe we all have in front of us. And
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, in front of you is a worksheet I put together in part for the co-chairs as they work through their process. And I thought it would be good to get you up to date where the numbers are in Department of Corrections, because there has been a new forecast. The top box is, real quick, this is a prison population forecast based on the difference between the April 2005 forecast, which actually was completed in March, and the October 2004 forecast, for which the governor's recommended budget is based on. There's savings of $10.5 million. That number is based or is already included in the two versions of the budgets that are out there. I don't want to spend my time on that. I want to move to the community corrections, because that's the topic of today. And this is a little bit more confusing because the governor, in his budget, introduces something called the BAN model, which I think you heard a little bit about last week with the Department of Corrections. And it does have an impact on the budget. If you take a look at the first column of numbers there, which is what's in the governor's recommended budget based on the October 2004 forecast, the essential budget level using the traditional model of forecasting, the one that has been used up to this point before the governor's budget, showed a need of $183 million. Then the governor made some adjustments in his budget, reductions of $9.3 million for revocation limitations and $9.3 million on limited risk supervisions. For a governor's budget before the BAN model of $164.5 million, and then he implemented something called the BAN model, which added funding of $9.6 million to the budget for a total 05-07 governor's budget for community correction grants of $174 million. Now, the purpose of the BAN model is to smooth out, for lack of a better term, the variation from one period to another in the community corrections grants. And I think generally everyone, or most people, are on board, both the counties and others, in moving toward that, because many of them had faced some significant changes over the past few years in their amounts based on caseload and the distribution of types of cases within that caseload. So that is a primary reason, I believe, and Craig or Mr. Campbell can comment on that, was the reason that it was put in the governor's budget. Now, the forecast comes along and things change significantly as a result. Under the traditional method of forecasting, the essential budget level becomes $190 million, $190.3. The same reductions are made, repricing that governor's budget before the BAN model of $171 million, or $171.7 million, excuse me. Then if the methodology that uses the BAN model is implemented in the governor's budget, it comes across as a reduction this time, because the change, you're using more up-to-date data on the distribution of the types of offenders, whether they're local control or their risk levels within the band model, it actually showed a savings of $8.5 million. So if you replaced or repriced the governor's budget based on the same assumptions that he used in creating it last fall, the governor's budget then would be $163.2 million. There's one other element of importance here. There's probably quite a few, but one is the opt-out threshold, for lack of a better term, and what that's interpreted as. As you recall, counties, if it gets below a certain level, if the funding level falls below a threshold, they are able to opt out, given 180 days notice, and in fact, two counties did that in the current biennium, Douglas and Linn counties. If the funding falls below that opt-out level or threshold, more counties could decide to opt out, give their 180-day notice, and their programs to be absorbed by the Department of Corrections. To add that to that threshold level, it would take, using the traditional model, of $27.1 million, and if you use the band model, as the governor did and assumed in his budget, and under the new repricing from the forecast, the amount required to prevent opt-outs from the band method, it needs to get back to $181.8 million, and it would take about $18.6 million. And I'm sure the counties will probably be discussing what level they would like to return about, but I thought it would be good to go through the numbers real quick so you get an understanding. It is rather complicated. If you want a discussion on the band model, I'd assume we try to do that, or the intricacies of the band model, I think it would probably be good to do that individually, and I would appreciate any help from the department if you want to do that individually. The other items within this packet, on the second page, is just a quick table on county contributions to the community corrections programs.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, to go back. So we just, some real numbers here. So if we look at what the co-chairs proposed, House proposed 27.1, which gets back to the 190.
Right.
And the Senate co-chair proposed 9.3, which is still under the 191.
Right. Under the House version of the budget, there is no way, in a sense, that the counties could opt out because they're at the upper level. I would argue that the 181 figure is probably the new threshold, but even the Senate budget is roughly $9 million under that level. So counties would for sure be able to opt out under the Senate version at this time.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, what would happen to the counties who did opt out if this new level was met above the opt-out? Do they have a choice to come back in?
I believe they do. I think it would probably be a question that you would, Representative Hanna, would address the department. I'm not sure. I'm looking for signal. They could opt or they could come back in.
And the person who signaled that response was who?
About three representatives, Madam Chair, from the department, but I'll signal Mr. Williams.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
I'd like for us to understand how that works, if we could, if it would just take a 2 or 3 minutes.
Certainly.
Because I do not understand what their options are, and because one of the counties I represent is one of the ones who has opted out, this discussion is going to come up, and I'd like to understand what their option is.
Let's get that on the record.
Madam Chair, I think Ginger Martin, who is the Assistant Director for Transitional Services, is going to come on the table, and she's had a long history within this program.
Great, and thank you for raising that, Representative. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director in the Department of Corrections. The question is about what is the process for counties to come to, again, assume responsibility for community corrections. It is essentially the opposite of the process that they went through to opt out, in which they would notify the department. We again start that 180-day transition period and transfer that responsibility and the employees and the property and the leases and all of the things that transferred to the state back to the county. This is the process we went through in 1996-97 when counties all took responsibility for community corrections.
Representative Hannah, would you like to continue?
I'd just like a follow-up, Madam Chair. Ms. Martin, would you discuss, is there an incentive, disincentive? Do you feel like we're going to put ourselves in a position of having people go back and forth here?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think the major incentive for counties to operate their own community corrections activities is the local decision-making and local control that that brings to the jurisdiction, as opposed to having, you know, a bureaucrat in Salem kind of being the top person. And I think that is the thing that county jurisdictions have valued probably the most about our current Community Corrections Act. There's no financial difference between state-operated or county-operated. The same allocation formula treats every jurisdiction in the same way.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Yes, a question for Doug, actually. In terms of the opt-out provision, we go to the new band model. In your best judgment, what would be the number under the new band model, and would it fit the statutory requirements where we would have to be for them not to have the ability to opt out?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I will first say it's not entirely clear because I don't think the statute's contemplated completely. In my discussions with legislative counsel and looking at the statute, I would at least make the preliminary argument that the $181.8 million new threshold, if the ban model is adopted.
And the follow-up, Madam Chair, and this is kind of not really material in a sense, but the House co-chair had recommended 190, and what had the Senate co-chair recommended?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, he recommended adding roughly 9 million. I can't remember if it's 9.1 or
9.3.
9.3.
So that would have been about 172 million,
yes,
roughly. Okay. I always like to split things in the middle.
Did you wish to continue?
No, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does talking about moving employees back and forth, that's an expense. Does the state or the county pick up them? You know, is there an expense for moving and relocating the employees that when you go back and forth like that?
Senator Gourley, Representative Wisnett, that employees typically stay put. Their paycheck comes from a different governmental body. So there are no inherent costs in that transfer.
Okay, well, let me, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
So the employees didn't move from Roseburg. They just went to work for the state as far as the probation. They did not relocate.
Senator Gourley, Representative Wisnett, that's correct. All of the same employees stayed in the same office doing essentially the same work for a different employer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Wilson, additional information?
Madam Chairman, subcommittee, real briefly, the other two pages just show the results of a survey that community corrections directors undertook late last summer, early fall, on the county contributions at that point for the current 2003-05 biennium. And I just put that in to demonstrate there that the counties locally have a commitment to the program, even though it varies significantly from county to county. There is no requirement that they put in a certain amount of money. Some counties choose to put in a significant amount. Some counties put in less than that amount. And this is just for your information as you work through it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
To expand on that, Mr. Wilson, so there's not a requirement, and it does not based upon population or anything, because we got amounts here from $3 million to zero and really small amounts. So I don't understand that concept. So does that mean the counties are not? I don't understand why we have the different amounts of money and what service is it providing to these people for recidivism and monitoring and all that, it doesn't make sense.
Madam Chair, Representative Lisnick, keep in mind that on the left hand of that side of that table is the state grant and the amounts they get. That is the amount that comes from the state general fund from the department. Counties are not required to put in general fund at the local level for property tax or other revenues, and some choose to put some in, some choose not to. All counties collect some kind of fees at the local level from offenders in terms of various services, but not every county decides to put in county general fund revenues.
I think how counties have chosen to implement this public policy will become clear as we get into the invited testimony. Representative Wisnot, so I'd ask you to hold your questions in mind and roll them out again when we bring the panel up. Mr. Campbell, would you like to open the presentation and...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the Governor's Senior Policy Advisor, and my responsibilities cover public safety issues. After testimony here yesterday, I come back before you, a changed man, and want to talk to you today a little bit, and I'll be fairly brief because most of the folks that know the detail on this information will be talking after me from the counties and other organizations. But I did want to talk to you about the fact that the Governor's Office convened a work group to talk about community corrections, largely as a result of a commitment that the Governor made at the release of his budget. We were quite aware that the counties were interested in moving to the two-band model, largely for the reasons that Mr. Wilson indicated, predominantly making sure that there's predictability when numbers can change very dramatically in the way that they are currently allocated. The new two-band model makes those fluctuations much more predictable and have much less impact on the overall budgeted amount for each of the local counties when they're dealing with their community corrections budgets. The group essentially was put together for the purpose of trying to reevaluating the agreements that were forged back in 1995 through Senate Bill 1145, which created the community corrections system, to try to essentially say, we've gone through 10 years. There's been some, I think, feelings of concern on the part of local government that the state has not been keeping up with its side of the bargain on community corrections. So the goal was to try to reconnect, find out what the state needed to do to make sure that it was being true to what we agreed to back then, and then to come up with a formal agreement to then move from this point forward. As a result of that discussion, we've come up with a few points. We're still having negotiations about what the final agreements will be, but I did want to update you on essentially where we're coming down at this point in time. The first would, of course, be to moving to the new two-band model for budget building. The second would be to agree that the new calibrated figures that result in the $181 million number are, in fact, based on a calibration, knowing that the numbers we're using actually do not reflect actual costs at the lower level, or at the local level. They're actually lower than actual cost is. But since we have not gone through the process of what will be a rather in-depth study over the next year to find out what those actual costs are, we acknowledge that that number is artificially low. In response to that, we're looking at the $190 million figure as the one that probably more accurately reflects over the full biennium what will be the opt-out number. There's no legal basis for that. That's something that we would be agreeing upon because we believe that what will happen is after you do that one-year period that, in fact, the new daily cost will actually be higher than the $190 million figure would reflect in the second part of the biennium. So, in essence, we're looking at an artificially low number at the beginning, a number higher than the $190 million figure after we get that study done. So, in fact, we're probably closer to an average of $190 million throughout the biennium. And the local level at this point in time looks like they're willing to agree to that as being the opt-out figure. And then what we would do with the new survey results is use those to build the budget for the 07-09 budget, and that we will do a periodic review every 2 years using some growth factor that reflects what we anticipate will be the actual growth in costs at the local level. and that subsequently we will do some larger evaluation like we're doing in the next year to see whether or not those growth factors actually are capturing actual cost at the local level. Obviously, the nitty-gritty, the devil's in the details, and we're still having negotiations about that. But at least that's where we are currently. That group represents local community correction directors, the Department of Corrections, the Governor's Office, community correction, I already said, and the Sheriff's Association, district attorneys. And I wanted to thank Senator Gurley for her and her staff being willing to participate and be observers during those meetings as well to keep up to date on them. I don't have a great deal more to add than that because the detail will be provided by some of the folks who will be talking to you today.
I do have a question about the agreement that you speak of, which is captured in a memorandum from you to members of the Community Corrections Work Group dated April 1. But is that a signed agreement? Signed in that the participants, the active participants in the work group signed on to
Madam,
agreement?
Madam Chair, no. That is the agreement that we put out for them to look at to decide whether they could agree on it, and then if they have changes to bring those back. And we are beginning to see some differences of opinion, not great ones, but ones that we will need to work through. And I obviously, there's an understanding in the entirety of the group that the legislature will do what the legislature deems is appropriate, and this group will be something that the governor's office and those who participate will be agreeing to, but obviously you will be the ones who will ultimately make the decision. But we will provide that to you as what we believe is the best position for the state to be in to continue policy-wise.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about the study reflecting actual costs, I would guess that the probation and post-prison supervision costs should be somewhat similar depending upon what the practice is in a county and what the compensation practices are within a county. But the cost of incarceration, I know, varies widely from county to county. And in many cases, far exceeds the cost of incarceration at the state level on a per-day basis. When you say reflecting actual costs, how do we maintain some degree of an arm's length transaction so we simply don't pick up costs just simply on the basis of whatever costs are attributed in the sense of the state here in the last biennium froze all cost of living increases, froze all step increases. Would we automatically be assuming that we would assume any cost of living increases that a county gave its employees or any step increases or any increases in health care benefits that a county gave, or would we still be a subject of negotiation?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's actually where the kind of the sticky wicket comes in because presumably what you would be agreeing to if in the current discussions is that you're trying to, as accurately as possible, capture actual cost increases. Now, some of those are controllable, some of them are not. But the decisions the state makes at the state level for controlling its cost by freezing salaries and so forth don't necessarily reflect a change that will occur at the county level. So in many ways what we're doing is we're hoping that our county partners will do what they can to control costs, but in many ways it's a contractual agreement with the local level to provide the service at the cost that they must incur to do that service. So I'm guessing that I can't provide you with details, but I think it's probably the worst-case scenario that you're looking at, where we're actually trying to make sure that we are continuing to maintain the costs that they actually incur, despite what we as a policy decide at the state level around budgeting.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask the question is, and I'm not trying to seem not supportive of the county's position in this, obviously, I worked a lot in the interim to restore funds to community corrections. But at the same time, all of us that are on Ways and Means have been basically cutting budgets for, this is going to into the third biennium. And we're not adequately probably funding many of the programs and having to make some cuts that we in many cases don't think are probably good public policy. But I'm wondering how we approach this with counties and know that that there has to be some degree of shared burden here. If we don't have the resources, they have to realize that sometimes we won't have all the resources necessary for this commitment.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, actually that was the reason for us getting together to create the agreement in the first place.
Yeah.
Because what has happened over the last few biennium is there's always been a confusion over the way that we reached the number as much as what the number is and whether we could afford it. The goal is to make an agreement that will say this is what the opt-out number will be, and then if the state doesn't have the resources, then we can negotiate with the local level and say we do not have the resources to provide you, and have that as being an open and transparent discussion, as opposed to looking at different ways of calculating the number in order to keep them within the agreement. So it becomes a much more clean and open discussion merely about the availability of resources. And I think you'll find that most of the counties have been willing to stick with us even during bad economic times without any real assurance that we would be able to provide them with the funding that we had hoped to.
I think this would be a good time to, I'm assuming that Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties, is one of the people next on deck. And given the conversation that we're having, At this point, would this be a good time to invite him up? And who else would you?
Madam Chair, it would probably be better for them to decide who best to be bringing up rather than myself.
I'm just wondering if you had anyone else.
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Let's make the transition then and come on up, Mr. MacArthur, and tell us who else is a part of your panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity, and we appreciate the discussion that's going on here today. Mike MacArthur, Executive Director, Association of Oregon Counties. Actually, today we have with us our President and Commissioner Tim Josie, Commissioner Tony Hyde, and Paul Snyder, who have the expertise in this field. And I'm going to yield to them to have this discussion with you.
Okay. Although, Mr. MacArthur, before you get away, I do know that you sought an opinion on the meaning of current service level, which is captured in ORS 423.483 from Scott Parker, Special Counsel. Will you be speaking to the information receivers? Is someone on your panel going to address that issue?
Madam Chair, Mr. Snyder will take that up.
All
with
right.
You.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator. It's good to see you again. A message to, I guess, to Craig Campbell is I've been involved in many bets in the past, but normally I'll bet a bottle of wine, but I think I'll leave my hair alone. Well, as you know, in 1994, Measure 11 passed and created mandatory minimum sentences, and as a result of that, Senate Bill 1145 passed in 1995 while I was in the legislature, and it created a new partnership between the state and counties, and most of this you know. And counties were responsible at that point in time for offenders serving a sentence of 12 months or less, and the state in turn is responsible for paying for this transition for these offenders to the local level at a current service level. And of course there's already been some discussion about what that means, and I'll talk just briefly about that in a minute. The counties entered into this with some trepidation, and as a legislator at the time I had some trepidation, but my sheriff was in favor of it, and then Craig's dad, Larry, was the Speaker of the House, and I didn't want his wrath, and then Kitzhaber was the governor, and this was his bill, and so I ended up voting for it. But the concern that I had at that point in time was when you enter into a partnership with a state, will the state always live up to its end of the deal? And, of course, that discussion will be fleshed out further, and I'll allude to that a little bit further. Prior to 1145, the average stay in prison for offenders of 12 months or less or a year or less was 4.4 months, and these same offenders spent 2.2 months on parole. So they basically had very little follow-up. When they were in prison, they just sat there. With 1145, the prison time and parole varies, but it's based on what's best determined by decisions made locally based on the offender and the program that they should be in. But the various services we provide range from mental health, alcohol, and drug treatment. Everybody agrees that the system that we have today is much better in terms of recidivism for the offenders and getting them back on track to be good citizens of Oregon. Now, I'm going to talk just a little bit about some of our concerns, and then I'm going to pass in terms of the current service level and just plan an idea with you, and then I'll have a Paul Snyder answer any questions. Tony will be speaking after I am. Tony Knight is the past president of the Association of Oregon Counties, and I apologize. I'm the president this year of the Association of Oregon Counties. If you look at the personal services cost per inmate from 1999-01 to 2005-07, and you compare the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections, Department of Corrections went up 16.5%, Community Corrections went up 6%. So if you take the implied current services level would go from $174.7 million to $203.5 million. And so we're still concerned about the true cost for the services that we're providing at the local level. I want to stress that I use these numbers as an illustration that more work needs to be done. We are your partners in a number of avenues, including this one. All we're really asking for, my take-home message that I'd like to give you today is that we'd like your budget people to work with our budget people and see if we can't come to something that we can all agree to. With that, I'll pass it over to Tony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Hyde, Commissioner from Columbia County, and I wanted to speak for a moment, if I could, about the importance of the entire opt-out issue to the counties. We are more than adept at making sure that the state shared services that we currently deliver have what we call a current service level, whether the funding's there or not. And I think we've demonstrated that over the years. I don't have the exact number, but there's only a handful, four or five counties, I believe, that do not supplement the district attorney's wage, which is paid for by the state of Oregon. We understand that that's not adequate enough to keep a good district attorney on staff, so we supplement that, and that's something that's discretionary for the counties. We do the same thing all through the criminal justice system, if you look at it. And that's a shared service that we deliver on behalf of the state. Court facilities is another example that we bear all the costs for the court facilities, even though it's a state court. However, with the passage of Measure 5 and 4750, we are at a point where we're no longer able to supplement any more services. And when you get past the current service level, it becomes a supplement. And the issue for us is not a threat that we're walked out. The problem for us is if we can't supplement, we still have the mandate to deliver that service, which means that we're encumbered in terms of lawsuits, etc., if we don't deliver that service, whether we have the current revenue or not. That's a very big issue for us, and that's why we're paying so much attention to the opt-out. Secondly, Senator Devlin, you asked the question about whether you could come in or not. I think it was you that asked the question of whether you could come in or out. Representative Whitson. I think that's a very important question, and we now have a case in point with Douglas County and Linn County. And I would invite you to pay attention to the wages that were increased significantly as a result of the opt-out. And I would think that as a result of the significant wage increase, that even with a current service level or a threshold that the counties agree to, Douglas County would be reserved at best at taking back 1145 with those new numbers, because they're quite a bit different than they were the day before they opted out.
Questions or additional comments? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last piece, could you re-explain that for me? The salaries were lower with Linn County, and then they were increased when it went to the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, as I understand it, and I see Mr. Williams in the back, he may be able to answer this more clearly, but the way I understand it is that when Douglas County opted out, the state, the Department of Administrative Services, no longer had a job number for the director and the community corrections officers. So they had to redo that number. And as a result, I don't have those numbers with me today. I just thought about that when the question was asked. But it was a significant increase. I mean, very significant increase for not only the director but all the community corrections officers. And the reason that we paid so much attention to that is because we were just waiting for the ripple effect.
Mr. Snyder?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please pull that microphone close to you. We want to make sure that we get your voice on to record.
Thank you.
And good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder with Association of Oregon Counties. There are folks in the back of the room who know this better than I do, Ginger Martin in particular, but my understanding of what happened was that up until the time that Douglas County, which was the first county to opt out, up until the time that they did, and for a period going all the way back to 1995, there were no state parole and probation officers. So there was that 9-year period where the state didn't have any. So when the state got back into the business, first with Douglas County, then with Linn County, the Department of Administrative Services did a review of similar state positions, similar state salaries, and came up with a dollar amount for those salaries that was commensurate with other state positions. And the result of that was, at least in Douglas County and to a lesser extent in Linn County, that there was a substantial increase in the compensation that was paid to those Douglas County employees when the state took it over.
Senator Devlin and then Representative Hanna.
Maybe Mr. Wilson might want to comment on this too. I think at different comparisons, and I just didn't want to go this without another comparison, I think your reference is, at least my understanding, exactly correct, is we no longer had people in those classifications. They went through the Hays system, came up with a new classification, and it came up with a higher salary than what they were being paid in Douglas County. Another example of that in the reverse direction is when we've looked at the issue of assuming Wapato. Our custody personnel, our correctional officers, are paid significantly less than some county correctional officers. And so I think there are some real issues there in terms of compensation systems and how the analysis is done. So, but I didn't want everybody to think that state positions were always paying more. The issue of our Wapato was clearly is that for the county to operate Wapato and for us to basically leave beds there would have been much more expensive than for us to operate Wapato, although that decision has not been made. So,
Madam Chair,
Mr. Wilson.
I do have some numbers, and they may be a bit dated, but just like almost anything else, the state isn't always the most expensive. It's not always the cheapest. I mean, counties, in terms of their wage rates, whether it's for parole, probation, or for jail, or deputies in the jails or whatever, vary significantly from one county to another. So in terms of Douglas County, and to a lesser extent, if my memory serves me right, about Linn County, you're right. There were significant differences even there. The state rate was slightly higher, but if my recollection is right, there were some county agencies that paid their parole probation, you know, even higher than the state's, but those were few, if I might remember.
Representative Hannah.
Madam Chair, thank you. The term significant has been used, and I'm more of a numbers person myself, but I don't want to get this wrong. I want to say when that transition occurred, those folks that went from county to state employee got in the neighborhood of a $12,000 a year pay increase. So that's that part of it. To Senator Devlin's point, after attending the meeting where the Wapato prison or county jail facility was discussed as a potential site for housing DOC folks, the discussion there, if I remember the comments from the Multnomah County commissioners correctly, is that their county correctional folks earn 30% more than DOC correctional people. And that was a major issue in terms of the state having them operate it for us. I'm sure there are some folks in the room who know those numbers very well, other than just off the top of your head.
Other comments or questions? Mr. Snyder, did you wish to proceed?
If I may, Madam Chair, we've got a couple of community corrections directors here who would like to speak with you a little bit. And with your permission, I'd like to stay at the table and then pick up on some issues that it's my job to address.
Very good. And thank you very much, Mr. Josie, and I believe it was Mr. Hyde. Thank you very much. I don't have a list of your names, so as you are saying them, if you would also spell your last names, that would be very helpful. And again, good afternoon, and thank you very much for making time to come over and assist us in our understanding of the issues of concern to you and to us.
Thank you, Chair Gordon and members of the committee. My name is Steve Leidy, L-I-D-A-Y. I am the Assistant Director for the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, where I oversee the Adult Services Division, which includes parole and probation. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come here today and provide some remarks about community corrections. And really, I think most of what you will hear from the various directors up here this afternoon will be about the operational side of community corrections. At a time when the legislature faces the demands of multiple priorities for public services and there simply are not enough dollars, the importance of community corrections has never been higher. The cost of corrections is consuming an ever-increasing piece of the pie as more prisons are constructed, and the cost of operating those prisons is then borne as significant financial obligations into the future. All criminal offenders begin their criminal activity in a local community. Individuals who commit crime were born, raised, have lived, and the majority will continue to live in a local community. The majority of criminal offenders sentenced for felony crimes are placed on supervision to a local probation department, where they may serve time in a county jail, but never leave that county. Of the remaining offenders who are sentenced to prison, over 90% will be released back into their county of conviction, where community supervision is then provided in the form of post-prison supervision. In raw numbers, approximately 12,700 inmates will be incarcerated in state prison, while there are approximately 30,000 offenders being supervised in our counties today. In percentages, that's approximately 29% of all the felony offenders being housed in state prison and 71% being supervised in the community. These numbers represent the state-funded population of felony offenders, and if you add approximately another 10,000 misdemeanor probationers, this moves the count closer to 40,000 individuals under supervision in our counties, numbers roughly comparable to a community the size of Tigard or Albany. To supervise offenders, communities are utilizing a balanced approach of supervision, sanctions, and services. Supervision meaning that offenders are monitored and that contact is maintained with their families, their neighbors, and their employers, making sure that victims are not re-victimized by failure to receive restitution or being subjected to unwanted or prohibited contact. Services are provided to ensure that offenders have access to cognitive thinking programs, drugs and alcohol treatment, and job search assistance. And then their involvement is monitored to ensure that they are successful in those programs. For sanctions, criminal offenders need to be held accountable. There needs to be swift and sure response when offenders do not pay back their victims, when they do not participate in treatment, or they begin to engage in criminal behavior. Positive change often occurs when a person is facing a consequence that is tailored specifically to that individual. In terms of effectiveness of community corrections in Oregon, Oregon's most recent data shows that more than 70% of these offenders under formal supervision do not recidivate. That means prevention of new crimes and of new victims. In Multnomah County, our most recent outcomes show a reduction to record lows for recidivism, both for post-prison supervision and probation, and the statewide numbers show similar trends downward across Oregon. In accordance with Senate Bill 267, which was passed in the last session, Oregon counties are using evidence-based practices. For a number of counties, compliance with this law is a natural progression of practices that have been implemented over the last 10 years. Oftentimes, when looking for a national model of what works, it is Oregon that is looked to. Some of those evidence-based practices include local programming such as alcohol and drug treatment, which has proven to be effective. This is evidenced by a study in 2003 in Multnomah County where there was a 46% reduction in rearrests of offenders referred to alcohol and drug treatment. The combination of community supervision and effective treatment reduces recidivism by nearly 30%, while incarceration alone actually increases recidivism by 7%. The balanced model of supervision, sanctions, and services is in line with the Oregon Department of Corrections study that found local community corrections such as community service and day reporting were more effective in reducing recidivism than just jail. Actually, I want to thank Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections, who helped author and push that bill through in the previous session. Also, Ginger Martin from the Department of Corrections, both who are partnering with counties to implement effective evidence-based practices. The limitations of the state budget are clear. As administrators of county community corrections programs, we understand and are dealing with our own shortfalls at the county level. The need to have cost-effective correctional programs has never been more important. When comparing the cost for individual offenders, the average cost of managing an offender in the community ranges from $7 to $11 per day. To place that same offender in prison averages approximately $64 per day. Under 1995's Senate Bill 1145, Oregon has created what may well be the best community correction system in the nation. Having had the opportunity to visit a number of other states and a number of other counties, it is strikingly apparent that the operational partnership between the state of Oregon and counties is working well. Public safety has been enhanced by several key areas. One, criminal offenders are managed in a way that enhances public safety through a reduction in crime. Secondly, cost-effective programs are used to effectively stretch the expenditure of every public dollar. Third, each county is able to design a correction system that is built upon their local jurisdiction's resources and strengths. And finally, the joining of resources along with the state where counties have stepped up to the plate financially. In the current biennium, the state funds community corrections in the amount of $183 million. In the same biennium, counties will contribute approximately $122 million of their own money to help manage community corrections. I'd like to make one final point about credibility of the public safety system. It's important that citizens know when the government says criminals are being held accountable that that is really happening. When the term probation and parole is used, the public should be able to trust that we are supervising, mandating participation in treatment, and responding with swift and sure sanctions when criminal offenders are in violation. Thank you for the opportunity to make those remarks, and I would ask some of the other directors to speak.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chair Gordley and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak about funding of community corrections today. My name is Abe Huntley. I'm from Grants Pass, Josephine County Community Justice, representing the southern reaches of our state. I supervise a small unit of parole and probation officers, about 15, and about 1,100 offenders there. The system developed in Oregon since the passage of Senate Bill 1145, as Steve said, as a model to other jurisdictions, and its effectiveness not only in supervision but in treatment of criminal offenders in the community through partnership not only with our state but also with our other criminal justice agencies and partners within the counties. It's allowed us to put into practice leading-edge research that is applied in each county, tailored to the specific needs of each county and its citizens and the people that we supervise. The parole and probation officers have a great deal of responsibility in managing the tens of thousands of offenders in our communities in Oregon. They're focused on developing long-term supervision plans that's directed at public safety primarily, but also, as you know, treatment, employment, housing, and your basic needs, even food at times. They're also working in areas of methamphetamine addiction, as you've heard a lot about recently, domestic violence, sexual offenses. We supervise these populations successfully and continue to implement new programs based on local needs, programs, and practices that have been proven to work, not only reducing crime but changing criminal thinking and behavior. In these times of fiscal struggle, there's no better value in public safety than community corrections as a multifaceted, holistic approach to people who have committed crimes and reducing crime. Not only as they function in our communities, but as they transition from prisons back to their communities after being in prison for many years. In deliberation, I urge you to consider partnerships that were created with our, that have been created with our local counties. Our local counties partnered with the state over the last 10 years, and the success that we have produced through forward thinking and hard work. To underfund community corrections would be a step back many years, turning counties to opt out, creating a fractured system, a system less effective in addressing concerns and difficult issues on a community and personal level. In closing, I ask you to give us the tools we need to continue to protect the citizens of Oregon and impact the lives of the people we supervise and their families. Again, I thank you for your time and your consideration.
Mr. Huntley, thank you very much. And thank you for coming over from Josephine County.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Comments or questions for either of the two gentlemen who have already spoken? Next panelist.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner, S-C-H-R-E-I-N-E-R, and I'm the commander of the Parole and Probation Division for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, so I probably traveled the least of anybody to get here today. And I'm also testifying on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors about the funding issues. Let me say that I am very proud to be serving in the state of Oregon in community corrections. I really, truly believe it is one of the best values, as you heard both Mr. Lyday and Mr. Huntley talk about, in the criminal justice system. The diversity of services and functions we provide are invaluable, and the top priority throughout community corrections is public safety. That is our number one goal, and we utilize tools as law enforcement officers and treatment and programming to help affect change. We work to contain behavior that presents a risk in the community, and we work to provide the programming and treatment to help people change. Marion County has a significant history of working in partnership with the state on community corrections. We always, in fact, when we were talking, I heard some folks talking about the funding level. the funding level. Sometimes it seems like the county is healthy, and sometimes it seems like the state is healthy. And one thing we can always count on is there's a balance there, and the county has a vested interest in helping out. Marion County has funded 4 parole and probation officers for as long as I can remember to provide supervision services, and they also provide significant assistance to Marion County in treatment services. They fund a lion's share of our alcohol and drug treatment. Marion County has been very invested in the no meth movement and is completely on board and aware that without treatment we're not going to curb this issue. In the last session, the Senate Bill 267 was passed. This was a great piece of legislation. It was one of the best pieces of legislation that we have seen. We need to maintain a current service level funding to provide both supervision and treatment if we're going to do this. One of the conversations I've had with our treatment programs has been in the past, there was a time when we knew less about what works, when we knew less about what kind of treatment, and we knew less about assessment and intensity of treatment and dosage, and some of the information that has come out in the last 10 years, that we used to actually really ask our treatment programs to serve as many people as we could. We had we have 3,600 people on supervision in Marion County. There's never enough money for treatment, and so we would refer many people to treatment programs, and in some ways it became a process issue. If they were in treatment and the numbers were high, but we weren't the ability to focus on quality, one of the things that Senate Bill 267 has given us is the tools to focus on quality. So now we're going around and doing correctional program assessment and inventories, as we were trained by Dr. Latessa. We're going and working with these programs, and we meet with our programs monthly, and we talk to them about how they conduct assessment and the fact that the highest risk offenders need to be into their programs with the greatest intensity and dosage, and how treatment should be structured. Those things also mean that treatment costs more money. And so we're not in the business anymore of saying to our treatment programs, you know, take 200 people. We're more saying, how many people can you effectively treat? And if that's 100 people instead of 200, then we're going to do it because it's the right way of doing it. So those are all issues that we have to consider. And when we talk about our funding system is a bit outdated, especially as we move into this new era with the information we have. And so I really strongly believe that we need to look at those factors as we follow up on evidence-based practices and move in the direction we're going. Also wanted to say strongly support the memo crafted by Craig Campbell and that committee on April 1 of 05. These recommendations create a sensible method for building and funding the community corrections budget and soften the fluctuating local control population. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me a guess, maybe all of you, what percentage of the people in your counties that need A&D treatment, the best type of applicable treatment, what percentage are actually getting treatment? How close are we to full funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, most estimates indicate that approximately 80% of the people we supervise have significant substance abuse problems. I can answer for Marion County. We have our primary substance abuse treatment program can serve around 150 people a year. We have other programs that we refer to, but we do not fund. And so people will go into those. Unfortunately, a lot of those are short-term programs. They're based on OHP and whether folks can collect insurance and how they can pay. And one of the really disturbing things is as we look at the data coming out about methamphetamine, we know that the somebody with a methamphetamine problem probably needs 6 to 12 months of treatment, and very often they might end up in a program that's 3 to 4 months at most in Marion County.
Okay, so the 150 is what percent of your total clients then?
Well, we serve 3,600, so if there's 150, it's a drop in the bucket at some levels. There are folks going in other levels of treatment. I don't want to make that sound too drastic, because there are people who it's appropriate to go into the shorter-term treatment programs as well. That's part of what assessment is about.
Representative Hansen, are you interested in information for all 36 counties?
Well, no, I'm just trying to get a snapshot. Right. But is it dramatically different in any other county?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in Multnomah County, we supervise anywhere from 8,500 to 9,000 offenders. We have approximately 200 beds for that population, residential treatment beds. We do have some additional outpatient slots. The challenge that we find is many of the people, for instance, that are addicted to methamphetamines also have housing problems. And so stabilizing someone is just as important when they're in treatment and initially upon their release from treatment as their time that they actually spent in counseling. So that's also somewhat of a drop in the bucket. And the majority of our alcohol and drug treatment is funded by the county.
Just to do a time check before we hear from our other panelists, we have about 15 minutes remaining for this discussion, and then we'll need to move into a budget hearing on the Criminal Justice Commission. I want to check with Mr. MacArthur. Did you have other panelists besides the gentleman at the table?
Madam Chair, we don't. Mr. Snyder and I would like to return to take up the issue you asked about at the outset.
That would be great. Well, let's hear from our other presenter.
Madam Chair, good afternoon once again. It's nice to see you and members of the committee. My name is...
And sir, if you could please pull that microphone again right around in front of your... Thank you.
Short and loud. I'm Richard Sly from Yamhill County Community Corrections, and I would voice the same points that my colleagues have here today. I'm here in support of adequate and full funding for community corrections, obviously throughout Oregon, and from a program perspective, very much like yourself as an elected official, we represent, we're your representatives in the community districts throughout the state of Oregon. We're in effect members of the criminal justice system at the local level, providing supervision, as you've heard, from felony offenders from prison to those placed on probation by the court. Actually, about 50% of our felony probationers, Representative Hansen, are methamphetamine and drug cases, so that is a significant issue. I recognize that you're wanting to move this along and had heard earlier that our testimony is limited to a couple of minutes. Interesting, I thought in my letter, 2 minutes. When a burglar kicked down the door of my house and used the pillowcase in our bedroom to haul off the loot, including several family heirlooms, he couldn't have been in our house more than a couple of minutes. We know an accomplished car thief can boost the family car in just a few minutes. Criminals cruising around the roadsides while we're busy at work and doing what we're doing today can steal personal information and identity in a matter of moments from our mailbox. The time to clear up the fraud can take hours on the telephone for victims and the complicated web of credit card fraud. If we're counting offenders in a criminal justice system, the greater number found in our homes and our home communities and districts. We know the solution is not exclusively in the funding of brick and mortar. The work of community corrections in our respective towns and districts is an investment in the idea there is a solution to the problem of sexual abuse, domestic violence, and the worrisome increase in methamphetamine abuse fueling property crimes in Oregon. In the 2 minutes, a skilled parole and probation officer can engage an offender to make necessary first steps to reorganize their lives, to be responsible citizens, to be responsible parents, and an officer can assess, as Mr. Leidy and Pat described here an intervention for accountability with a short prison sentence or a short jail term, a structured intermediate sanction, or a placement in a drug-free house, or like in Yamhill County, an Oxford house where people are committed to sobriety. I thank you for the opportunity to offer my thoughts this afternoon. We urge the committee to provide adequate funding for the work at Community Corrections. I think you'll find, from a cost perspective, that community supervision is a bargain for the dollars. Community Corrections complements police work. Community Corrections is evolved in Oregon as a sentencing option for relief on prison beds. And locally, our officers provide, through sanctioning and other systems, an efficiency to the DA's office and the court to act upon violations that don't go into a formal show cause hearing. Community Corrections, finally, is the local bridge between addiction and treatment. And the probation officer's role, this is very critical. And thank you for the opportunity to squeeze my thoughts in.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here to share those thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity to continue this discussion. Our association is concerned about what the actual costs are. I appreciate the way Mr. Campbell characterized the problem, that we should not try and find a formula to fit the amount of money, but actually determine what the actual costs and the appropriate level of funding for this program. So Mr. Snyder has some information he'd like to add to the record here as a matter of background.
Thank you, Mike. Madam Chair, thank you so much for this chance for us to present this information to you. I'd like to just run the committee, the subcommittee, down through some of the things that have happened because they're important to where we are today. There have been a series of unfortunate events that happened in community corrections funding. The good news is that the Legislative Assembly, when it's confronted those events, has made an effort to correct them, and we're hopeful it will be done one more time. In 1995, when this act was passed, it was brought to counties in the form of a concept, and Representative Hansen knows this very well. Nobody knew where we were going in terms of any real history that could inform us as to the path that we were going to take, so some assumptions were made. Several of those assumptions turned out to be false. The first assumption was that the average daily cost for operating a jail bed in the state was $65 a day. The second one that proved to be false was that the average cost of supervising an offender outside of jail was $7 a day. But that's the number that we worked from in 1995. It's the number on which the budget was built that session. In the 1995 session, another provision was added to the bill in this subcommittee that tied the county inflation rate to the department's inflation rate. It said basically, in effect, you give the counties an inflation rate that's no less than the rate that you give to the department, but you don't have to give them any rate that's higher than that. I think with respect to that provision and the way the law has been interpreted since then, nobody knew that this was going to become a problem until it became one later on, and I'd like to share with you a little bit about how that happened. That first assumption, that $65 a day and $7 a day, was revised. In the 1997 session, which was the first full legislative session, first full biennium that we had experience with this, counties were already concerned that the appropriation wasn't going to be enough. So the legislature appropriated to the emergency board $7.5 million in the emergency fund that the counties could access if it was necessary following a review of actual county jail costs. That jail cost survey was not done in time during that interim period from 97 to 99, so the $7.5 million reverted to the general emergency fund. It was never accessed.
In the 1999 regular session, Representative Mannix introduced a bill based upon the survey results that had now come in on jail cost survey. That survey showed $76 a day is the appropriate number for county jails, compared with $65 a day on which it was built in 95. And that $19 a day is the appropriate level for supervision, compared with $7 a day on which the 95 budget was built. So there was a huge discrepancy between what the survey results showed as actual cost and what the amount was originally appropriated. In the 1999 session, the base budget was recalculated. We began in 99 with a new base. Now, some of the materials that you have here, one of them, another unfortunate event, I think, this provision from the 1999 regular session is an attachment to your materials. It shows a deletion that was taken out of the law that session when the base was reset. That provision that had been in there said that the department will biennially determine the actual impact and cost of managing the offenders, and the inflation obtained by the department under this subsection shall be factored into the establishment of the baseline for the future biennium. That provision was deleted when the base was reset. And it was based on the assumption, well, we'll just track with inflation after this, so we don't need this provision. Well, when the base was reset in 1999, that created a new base for 99-01. Since then, let's take a look at some of the things that have happened. Remember, 01-03 biennium, it was set, it was rolled out at that base level. But in 01-03, we had six special sessions. Those special sessions withdrew any inflation rates for the counties that would have otherwise resulted. And my understanding from talking with Ginger Martin is that for 03-05, there was no inflation factor then either. Now, something that we need to explain to you that is the subject of the opinion that that Senator Gourley referred to just a little bit earlier has to do with the difference between how state agency budgets are built and the way the community corrections budget is built. Every state agency, as I understand it, includes in its base budget the roll-up cost for PERS rate changes, the roll-up cost for medical insurance premium increases, the roll-up cost for merit increases and step increases, and related personnel costs that are calculable. All those things are rolled up, including collective bargaining agreement negotiated changes. All those things are rolled up into the base budget for every state agency. So that is not an inflation factor. Remember when I mentioned earlier in my testimony that the decision was made to say, well, the counties only get the inflation factor that the department gets, and in 03-05 the department didn't get an inflation factor. The department did get all those costs I described rolled up into its base budget. It did in the preceding biennium before that and the biennium before that. And so what we have from our point of view is a situation where we have a growing disconnect between the actual cost to the counties. And remember, most counties are PERS counties. We incur the same medical insurance premium cost increases as you do, the same pressures as you do, the same collective bargaining agreement situation that you do. We're not subject to binding arbitration for parole and probation officers as of last session. All these things apply to the counties just as well as they do to the state. And it's our view that these costs are covered in the state budget, in its base budget, and they're not covered in the counties. So one of the things that we've done is to get together with Ron Chastain, who's an economist who used to be working here for several years with the Legislative Revenue Office, to take a look at these factors. And one of the handouts that you have in your packet is a chart that's called Draft 4-1905 Community Corrections Current Service Estimates. This estimate was done in communication with the Department of Administrative Services, asking that they break out the personnel costs of the department for the institutional budget, and then factoring into that the number of inmates who, or the amount of money, the amount of money basically per inmate, dividing that total amount by the inmate cost. And what this shows, the point of this chart is to show the inflation rate that was actually awarded to the Department of Corrections during the same period of time, comparing it with community corrections funding. Now, this also projects out to 2005-07, and I tried to listen real carefully to Mr. Wilson describing all these numbers, and I already know these numbers, and I'm still confused about the band rate, about the current service level, about all the different calculations. However, when you put these things together, trying to isolate and compare apples to apples, the next page of that chart indicates what community corrections funding level would be if the same factor had been applied to community corrections as was to the department in its base budget. That funding level would now be at $203.5 million, which is different from any of the numbers that we've already discussed. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, what we would like to do with this information is to ask you to have staff and Department of Administrative staff work with us to identify the correct numbers and compare apples to apples so that we can achieve a funding level that tracks with the actual county cost changes over the same period of time.
Are there questions or comments? Representative Hansen and then Representative Wisner.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Clearly, this is an obligation that the state occurred when we did 1145. Now, what that correct number is, I'm sure it's on one of the pages here somewhere, but there's a lot of different numbers that I think would be very valuable for us to find out what that correct number should be. I don't know if we can fund it, but at least we need to know what it is so we and the public realize how close or far we're away from funding what we set out to do in 1145.
Representative Wisnot, and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Wilson and Mr. Snyder, I guess, I was in the county at this time. If I'm not mistaken, part of the problem was the state didn't fund it at all. Didn't we withdraw our funding completely? It wasn't that we didn't catch up or try to reimburse the county. We were saying we were going to cut it off completely. We didn't have the funds to fund to provide it. Is that correct, or am I incorrect in that?
I'm not, Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I'm not sure exactly what your question is or the action.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the clarification. Thank you. What, I thought the state was not going to fund, provide the county any of the money, and they didn't have the money. It wasn't the amount of the rate that was being decided. It was the actual funding that the state was going to provide the counties. Is that, am I incorrect in that?
I think I'll let Mr. Snyder, because I was around doing this in 1995 or whatever. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, it may depend on what point in time you're describing this last biennium. Remember that ballot measure 30 was on the ballot. And the reduction package that was triggered when Measure 30 failed included a disappropriation of community corrections money in the point of $17.8 million. That money over the biennium, though, was restored by the emergency board, half in April and half in November.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's, again, from my experience with the county level and juvenile, you know, and working in that Commission on Children and Families, I think this is a good program. I think this Director Williams would agree that he doesn't want these people back there. But I think the state needs, as Representative Hansen said, if we're going to do this, we need to take the obligation on and fund it. And fund it at a level and build in an inflation factor or whatever. Don't be coming back and doing it every year. Have it related some way to the DOC operation. So that would be my recommendations on this, Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, I have no objections to this exploration of possible cases that can be made for other funding scenarios. In fact, I think there may be some benefit in that. As the chair is aware, we have probably five different scenarios at least on what the appropriate level of funding is for community colleges, depending upon a person's viewpoint. But I would remind everyone that we are in a zero-sum game here, and that whatever number we settle upon, if it's higher than the governor's number was in his original budget, it's going to probably come from somewhere else. Both co-chairs have eliminated, I believe, the SB 550 funds from juvenile corrections. The higher this number goes up, the chances that you're going to be able ever to restore any of that number diminishes to practically zero. The higher that we increase something like this, that if we consider this mandated or something, that we have, there may be other county programs in which we have to diminish funding. We don't print money here. We basically allocate it. And so there is a zero-sum game here that we are playing.
Other comments? Mr. MacArthur.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate very much Senator Devlin's comments, and also want to thank Senator Devlin for his work in the interim in restoring this funding to get us to the above the opt-out level. I bring your attention back to the Campbell memo, and that's where we are in this project. Our organization, our board of directors, was informed of the Campbell memo and also the opinion rendered by Scott Parker about current service level. When we asked what does the statute mean, and Mr. Parker came back and said that current service level should be applied to community corrections funding. So our organization agreed with the Campbell memo with the provision that the budget for this biennium would be adjusted by a current service level factor. We're not quite sure what that is yet, but that we would use the method from the previous biennium, adjust it, and then do the studies that we're talking about in the future. The other thing our organization said, based on the Sheriff's Association recommendation, is that the periodic review would be every 6 years rather than every 10. So with those two adjustments, our organization is in support of the Campbell memo.
What I'm going to suggest here, because we do need to make a transition, and again, very appreciative of your time and the time of the other panelists in coming forward and helping to flesh out what the issues are. We will take into serious consideration your suggestion, recommendation, pass it on to the co-chairs, that's my intent, and make a determination about how we will proceed from there. I think that Representative Hansen is right. We do need to determine what is the accurate number. And that means we need to determine what should be the investment of the state and this legislature in this public policy. And so I think that's where we can leave it for now. Does that meet your satisfaction for the time being?
Madam Chair, thank you. I think we're on the right track, and if the people that are working this issue for us, with our technical folks, can work with LFO to help unpeel this issue, I think that we might make progress.
There's progress that needs to be made within the constraints of this legislative session, and then there's progress that can be made in the interim, again, looking at the issues which have been further clarified for all of us. So I'm kind of looking at both tracks, if that makes sense.
Right.
If that makes sense to both of you.
It does to me.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, it does.
Thank you very much. Again, appreciate your time. And we're going to close the hearing on the House Bill 5016, which is the Department of Corrections, and open a hearing on House Bill 5020, Criminal Justice Commission. And Mr. Krims, Executive Director of the Commission, if you'd like to come forward and help us get started?
Sure.
Madam Chair, the subcommittee is saying this is on the schedule today, partially to stay within Mr. Campbell's schedule. We know that he and Mr. Prinz wanted Mr. Campbell to meet Craig's. To discuss what the governor's sort of outlook for the community or the the Criminal Justice Commission is, and I think that's probably the most important thing to do today. We will return to this budget on Thursday to do the general presentation by Mr. Prinz and Ms. Gilbert.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, before Mr. Campbell speaks, I wanted to give him a hat before he speaks in championing my agency budget to help his credibility factor.
Madam Chair,
Senator Devlin,
I wanted to share my note that I hope that the photographer that was here had captured Mr. Campbell for posterity.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the Governor's Senior Policy Advisor, and wanted to talk a little bit about today what the Governor's vision for the Criminal Justice Commission is. It became very apparent during the interim as we were conducting a rather large public safety overview that there was the need for a consistent, long-lasting ability within the executive branch of government to have a group that would be broad-based, independent, and bipartisan that could really look at those issues that were arising as challenges to the public safety system and give a long-term thoughtful response so that when the legislature met, it had the benefit of having some folks who had been able to put together recommendations on how to best proceed in addressing those public safety concerns. I'm sure all of you are aware of organizations like the Washington State Policy Institute, which as part of their responsibility not only bring together knowledgeable people to discuss policy issues, but also have the ability to do research and really get into the nitty-gritty of what other states and, in fact, sometimes other countries are doing to adopt the best practices for responding to the needs of the public safety system. Obviously, the Criminal Justice Commission is not in its current form capable of taking on that task. It plays some very critical roles, specifically for the legislature, around data gathering and reporting and doing some specific tasks. For instance, the law enforcement contacts committee and work around the asset forfeiture committee that it does. Those are critical roles. However, they don't have staff to do much beyond that responsibility, and that was the reason the governor had put the additional amount within the governor's budget for purposes of allowing the Criminal Justice Commission to expand that role. And in addition, we are putting through a bill, Senate Bill 95, that would expand the number of people on the commission so that it can have a broader representation. And the goal is really to get a lot of good minds around the table to try and address these issues during the interim. That gives you kind of a general background. I know you're all familiar with the skip that occurred at the beginning of this legislative session that identified all of those issues that the public safety system faces, and it would be good to have a home for those discussions to be debated and discussed so that you would have the benefit of the wisdom of those outside this building during the interim.
Speaking of homes for that topic, for that type, for that quality of discussion, there is a bill that would create a public policy, criminal justice public policy entity at Portland State University, Hatfield School of Government. Could you talk about what the connection is?
Yes, Madam Chair. Currently, the Criminal Justice Commission has some contracts with the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government for purposes of doing specific research around public safety issues. And I would imagine, although
it is not envisioned that the Criminal Justice Commission early on would ever be able to do internal research. Eventually, that might be something we would be able to attain. They will need to have access to organizations like Portland State University to conduct research. And what you would have the Criminal Justice Commission do would be to guide the direction for that research for them to essentially tag the Portland State University function and say, these are the areas we would like you to look into to help us form good policy.
Why do we need both entities, the PSU approach and the Criminal Justice Commission?
Madam Chair, it's really because of the people you can have on the Criminal Justice Commission, the people you can draw into that as appointed private sector, public sector folks. Portland State University is really a research entity. They do specific research. That's where their knowledge is. And you need to have the ability to have a broad public discussion around that, and having a policy institute acts as a good backup to that, but doesn't really take the place of a good formal government structure of appointed individuals who you can select to represent a very broad perspective and have open discussions about those sort of things. I suppose eventually you could move to a model where the Criminal Justice Commission could take that role on entirely internally, where it would both have the policy board that could discuss these issues and could also do the research internally. I think that's something that would be that we would need to look at down the line as opposed to immediately.
Did you have additional comments, Mr. Campbell?
Madam Chair, I try to keep my my comments as brief as possible. When I don't need to add words, I try to avoid doing so.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Prinz again. I don't know how much time. Do you want me to just go ahead and get started? Do you want Ms. Gilbert to present? How would you like us to proceed?
I would suggest that this is a good place to stop and reflect on all that we've heard today and to think about your coming presentation.
Okay.
Mr. Campbell, I'd like to thank you for helping to set the tone. Mr. Prince, I would ask you when you come back to share your thoughts about the collaboration with PSU.
I'd be happy to.
And to also share your vision about an enhanced role for the Criminal Justice Commission. What if the commission were to take on a role that included research, that included seeking out grants, played a greater collaborative role in our overall public safety system, public safety / judicial system. What would an enhanced role look like?
Mm-hmm. I would be happy to take that opportunity.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may make one comment, that is, I wanted to thank you and the staff for being so accommodating of my schedule. You've really bent over backwards, and I very much appreciate that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Any other comments for the good of the order, Mr. Wilson?
For the rest of the week, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, tomorrow is the district attorney's. That notebook was delivered to your office yesterday. And then on Thursday will be the Criminal Justice Commission and their agency presentation and public testimony, as well as, if approved by the co-chairs, a work session on the parole board. That doesn't show up on your schedules you've had before, but we will be sort of intermixing things on work sessions as we are ready and the co-chairs are ready to move on certain budgets. The Board of Investigators, which was originally scheduled for today, has been delayed because they're working out some organizational issues, and that will be coming back to you later. I'm not sure exactly when. So that hopefully make sure we get the right notebooks. I'll send out an email to your staff so we hook up on the right notebooks for the next 2 days.
Senator Devlin?
Are we generally getting the perspective that given the number of bills that have come out of committee, the number of grants that have come out of committee, that we probably have a full next Friday to deal with some of this?
I don't know.
There's no...
I have no idea, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin.
Representative Wisner.
Madam Chair, thank you. As a question I had, when would we expect to, like, present the military to the full House and the Senate? Is that
unusual? Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, usually at this point in a session, we are having subs every once a week or once every other week. So if there is a sub or a full, excuse me, a week next week, that would be when you hear the military department, most likely. As if you move toward the end of session, you start having full committee on a much more regular basis or a much more frequent basis. And start, as, you know, attempting to turn around the budgets as fast as possible. Follow up.
I assume that, Mr. Wilson, you helped me put together a presentation or have a...
For the military department. Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I think Susie will, will help you put together a presentation.
Thank you.
If there's no further business, then I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5020 and close the hearing. And thank you.